Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, July 31st, 2017. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 72-year-old monthly of political analysis, cultural criticism, and intellectual probity from a conservative perspective. Please join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe. $19.95 gets you a digital subscription. $29.95 gets you an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hello, Abe.
I am Abe Greenwald.
Yeah, we will explain why Groot-like Abe is now I am Abe Greenwald in a minute. And Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
Abe, please enlighten the listeners as to why you have declared yourself to be Abe Greenwald.
Well, first I want to thank all my fans out there, all my people who voted for me or voted for the statement I am Abe Greenwald in a Twitter poll conducted by Andrea Ruth that pertained to our last podcast, which had to do with Noah's contention that Trump was instigating a purge at the White House. So the poll was, you had three choices. This is a purge, not a plan, or a plan, not a purge, or maybe a plan is not a purge, or a purge is not a plan. And then most important, the final option was you could vote for I am Abe Greenwald. And I sweat. Purge, not a plan, got 32%. Plan,
that
not
was
a
Noah.
Purge. Right, got 11%.
That was me.
Yes. And I am Abe Greenwald, a whopping 57%.
57%. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of votes, by the way, everybody. So just to let you know, you are all Abe Greenwald. Now, ordinarily, that would suggest that something terrible had happened to you, Abe, because the phrasing, I am blank, now usually refers to a mass something, people, you know,
solidarity
expressing solidarity after something horrible, like Salman Rushdie getting a fatwa on him or Charlie Hebdo getting shot up. So I'm not sure that this is entirely salutary for your future.
Let me have it.
It's praying.
Noah, I want...
I'm enraged by this,
Noah,
because I told Andrea that there are tons of Abe fans out there that are just dying for a venue to express their affection for Abe Greenwald, and she tainted this poll with the opportunity to hijack it.
And, you know, basically the next cover of Commentary in the September issue is going to be Win a Dream Date with Abe Greenwald, who is the only one of the three of us who is, in fact, single.
In need
single.
Of a dream date, yeah.
Noah.
I may soon be single because the shame of,
the
losing,
shame of losing to Abe
is Noah's, a dishonor for which my wife, I don't know if she can recover.
Noah's competitive streak is an interesting...
Yeah, I didn't expect it.
We were unaware just of how competitive Noah was, and we're going to have to, I think, continue to test some of this, maybe with some more Twitter polls that we will conduct ourselves, though it was
Twitter
very...
trolls.
Troll polls. Very kind of Andrea Ruth to take an interest and try and sponsor this Twitter poll on her feed and at Andrea N. Ruth. So you should follow her for being such a resolute fan of the Commentary Magazine podcast. You know, because let's face it, life is not just all talking about politics. Life is also Twitter polls and cat videos and hilarious and delightful memes and of course the
eternal disgrace and dishonor
to Noah. Noah's eternal or is it Noah who's eternally disgraced and dishonored or is it Theon Greyjoy? But I'm not going to talk about Game of Thrones. I said I wasn't going to talk about Game of Thrones, even though it was a fantastic episode last night, but I'm not going to talk about Game of Thrones. What I am going to talk about, however, is the question of leadership, which is, of course, the issue in Game of Thrones. Ultimately, it is a show about leadership and the horrors of politics in a world without morality. We are looking at a panoply of issues facing the United States over the past week to 10 days. Defeats for the White House, this humiliating defeat for the White House in the Senate on basically any kind of health care bill that could be thrown up there. Anything. This proposal, that proposal, got a few of this, got some of that, got nothing. Then they had the skinniest proposal. They had so skinny that Tom Carvel couldn't sell a diet ice cream, this skinny. And that failed too, right, by 3 votes. So we got that. And then we have, I think I'll let Noah explain, a sanctions bill toward Russia for its interference in the 2016 election and other things that goes beyond other sanctions bills passed by the House and Senate, not only because it was passed by not just a veto-proof majority, but it was practically 97
to 2.
It
was like 5 people voted against it in the entire Congress.
Right. 3 in the House and 2 in the Senate. So it's not only veto-proof, it's like hilariously veto-proof, I would say. And for those who believe that the presidency should be unambiguously, how would you describe it, like a primary in foreign in American foreign policy, should have the whip hand in American foreign policy over Congress, this bill is significant because it arrogates power to the Congress and seizes it in some sense from the presidency. Noah, do you want to elaborate on this?
Yeah, sure. This bill is a sanctions bill. It imposes sanctions on Russia, but also North Korea and Iran. And the extraordinary nature of it, insofar as it takes some power away from the presidency, is it doesn't. It allows the White House to have some leeway with implementing these sanctions, but it doesn't give them any leeway to take them off. The president has to, they involve sanctions against Russia for interference in the 2016 elections and also invading and annexing territory in Ukraine. And in the event that they want to soften any of those, should they ever want to, they would have to go to Congress and they would have to demonstrate in concrete terms that certain conditions have been met in order for those sanctions to be relieved. And the charitable explanation for why the White House objected to this is that it stole power away from the executive, and the executive branch and the legislative branch have a natural tension, and that's a good thing. You know, that's part of the system. But there has been a level of deference on foreign affairs to the executive from Congress stretching back for decades, and it's only been accelerating from the perspective of the outside observer, at least to me. And the fact that the presidency is now being sort of handcuffed here a little bit on a foreign affairs policy, and the fact that it has to do with Russia is entirely unique to the Trump administration. So I don't say that this is necessarily a trend, but it is nevertheless pretty interesting.
It's not entirely unique, because the idea of compelling the White House to demonstrate to Congress that conditions are being met for the lifting of sanctions was the key element of the Jackson-Vanik bill of 1974 that placed sanctions on the Soviet Union for its behavior pretty much toward Soviet Jews who wished to emigrate. And that bill, which was objected to by the Nixon White House and very much was a thorn in the side of people who believed in the strong executive, including Henry Kissinger and others, was nonetheless a signature achievement in creating social pressure and putting the world on notice about this terrible human rights abuse.
Two things there. One is that, I mean, it sort of makes the point, if we have to dip back 40 years in the past to support the fact that this is, you know, something that's not, it's not very frequent that it happens. But also, was this, in your opinion, Jackson-Vanik, in a sort of an expression of fear that something like human rights, humanitarian causes in the Soviet Union could be sacrificed upon the altar of détente?
Completely. I mean, that was why Jackson-Vanik was so important, right? So you have this condition. So I think what one of the things that we should say is that one of the ways that these bills are softened, and particularly softened when they're being passed by the Congress, which is in the hands of the same party as the president, is that precisely that it gives that the Congress being friendly toward the presidency will give it some wiggle room and give it some will not require that it prove things to the House before the House can act to change things, but we'll sort of assume goodwill on the part of the White House, and that the White House is following the law and wants the law to be followed, and will do what it will do. And the phrasing and structure of this sanctions bill kind of assumes bad faith on the part of the White House toward Russia.
We all understand why.
But the fact that it is almost explicit here, and remember, it's passed not only by every Democrat but by almost every Republican. I mean, I think the people who voted against it were extremely the idea that it was necessary to presume bad faith on the Trump administration's part toward Russia, that is new. I don't think that the idea was that, you know, the White House would sacrifice human rights on the altar of détente per se. It was more that the Nixon White House was, and the Ford White House after, were you know, aiming for bigger fish, right? They were trying to create grand designs and grand deals with the Soviet Union, and so their claim was, you can't limit our freedom of movement here, our freedom of policymaking here, because what we're doing is we're attempting to save the world from, you know, nuclear cataclysm or whatever. And that was deemed not sufficient to the day to, at the time, to excuse the Soviet Union for its genuinely barbaric treatment of a class of people who were being, you know, viciously treated and discriminated against simply for the fact that they wished to leave a totalitarian state to practice their faith and be Jews openly in the world. And so so it's got a different flavor, doesn't it? Because this is like, well, we can't trust Trump because we don't know whether he's in the pocket of the Russians or not. You know, it's a pretty kind of the subtweeting here is very loud.
Well, yeah, it is, and it's in a way necessary, but also in a way kind of a political statement that's not motivated by any facts on the ground. The president, long before this bill was passed, the president has been clear and his administration has been clear that they have no interest in relieving any sanctions that have anything to do with the invasion of Ukraine. They've tied it very clearly, the sanctions on Ukraine or on Russia vis-a-vis the invasion of Ukraine will remain until the peninsula of Crimea is evacuated by all Russian personnel, e.g. never. So they've been pretty honest about that one. And the sanctions with regard to the 2016 election, they've been kind of on the table, but the president hasn't moved on them and Russia hasn't moved on them. And finally today we saw, I believe it was late yesterday, they saw Putin lose all patience and finally retaliate belatedly for the removal of some diplomats and the seizure of some diplomatic property in the United States in December of 2016 by the Obama administration in retaliation for the intervention in the 2016 election cycle. Tension is just sort of is something that we've seen the presidency embrace, even though they were very lenient towards and conciliatory towards Moscow, but sort of the institutional pressures that are on the presidency forced them to be hostile towards Moscow. So this act by Congress is extraordinary, even more so from the fact that they're acting on suspicion and not any sort of concrete evidence of concessions towards Moscow.
I have to say, this is all making me, it's reminding me once again of how sort of outrageous the Obama White House's engagement with Iran was in terms of things like relieving sanctions and, in fact, negotiating a very dangerous nuclear deal that they left Congress out of entirely.
Well, Congress bought themselves back into it.
Well, it did, although Congress bought themselves back into it in an almost impossible structure, right? So the idea was that what was agreed to was the notion that Congress would vote on a bill in a reverse treaty fashion, so that if the Iran deal had been submitted to the Senate as a treaty, which is really what it is, the Senate would have to pass it by a two-thirds majority for it to become a treaty, right? So instead, the how would you describe this? The treaty could only be disapproved or not implemented according to an agreement between the Obama administration and the Senate if two-thirds of the Senate voted to disapprove the deal.
Right.
Not to approve it, but to disapprove it. And so that structure was, you know, unprecedented, and it was all based on the accepting the false claim that it was not a treaty.
Right. But that sort of reinforces the point that we're trying to make here, which is that even then, in a hostile Congress, there was deference to the White House's authority to have really broad leeway to execute American national security objectives without the interference of the legislature.
Right.
The congressman would say things like, "I'm very worried about this, but okay, fine."
Yeah, or they would say they were worried, and then they would get this, "Well, you obviously want there to be nuclear war because the only choice is this deal or war." Right.
And you're still seeing that from the bizarre nexus of pro-Trump right and intercept left, who are united in their antipathy towards the middle of the country's frustration with a nation that is purely revanchist and is threatening the peace in Europe and the Middle East, and how dare we notice this.
Right, we're being scolded for our Russophobia.
Mm-hmm. Right. It is kind of an amazing thing to see this. These are the interesting figures.
The nation left and
Well, I think the intercept left is the right, because, of course, the interesting thing here is that it's a lot of this is being led by the very people who made their bones by accepting traitorous leaked documents that were clearly part and parcel of a. If it was not an explicit Russian aim to get all of U.S. intelligence on everything, or Chinese aim, it was certainly implicit in their what they desired. But I mean, to get back to the central point here, you have the sanctions bill passing by this overwhelming margin, meaning that Trump could veto it or not veto it, and his veto would be overridden. No president wants to see, and if he decides he has to veto it on principle, whatever his principle would be here, executive authority or whatever, it's overridden, then he will appear very weak. If he signs it, he will appear to be very weak, and that image of weakness will be reinforced by what Vladimir Putin announced was going to happen at the end of September, failing any reversal of this policy, right?
Yeah, and there's one more indication. I mean, sure, there's several, but the one that came up before we started the podcast, one more indication of Trump's weakness here, and that is regarding North Korea, how he has tried to take a different tack, approaching the Chinese to help us do something about North Korea. I think in all, not a crazy approach. I mean, because...
no one else has ever thought of that before.
Well, no, but still. But I mean, dealing directly with the North Koreans is, through carrots, and doesn't work terribly well because they sort of ramp up threats and then get more out of us, and our military options are miserable. But in any event, China has not done what Trump has envisioned it doing, and he has, as is his wont, taken to whining about it on Twitter.
Oh, they had done something. They did sanction a Chinese bank, which is a first when it comes to American foreign policy. They're trying to squeeze China a little bit, or
squeeze the North Korean money supply
via China.
Right. Now, but I mean,
so it's something. I mean, people talk about putting the screws to China all the time, but nothing's ever been done about it.
But it just strikes me that, even talking about this, like the entire structure of the West's effort to deal with the North Korean nuclear program from the time the North Korean nuclear program became public in 2002 was to lean on the Chinese. The six-party talks were...
That's right.
It's all about leaning on the Chinese because nobody else has any leverage with North Korea, and if China were to cut off North Korea, North Korea would die. I mean, it has no, it's its only largest or only trading partner, and you know, it's where it gets all of its resources that it does not have because no one else will trade with it or ship to it and all of that. So once again, the Trump administration's trumpeting the idea that they've come up with this incredibly innovative strategy right. to pressure the Chinese to force the North Koreans either to the bargaining table or to do something is more, you know, just more hot air. I was struck, by the way, last week, speaking of the weak presidency or the weak, you know, the overall presidency, this weird, bizarre detail that State Department spokesman Heather Nauert said that Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, was going to take a couple of days off. Now, she didn't say it in the context of like, well, he's got some vacation time. He's going to, you know, he's going to his ranch, but he'll, you know, he'll still be doing work or whatever. She was like, he's taking a break from the Secretary of Stateship because it sucks so badly, you know. We had all these stories last week about how, you know, there was this kind of unilateral disarmament of the State Department going on. It's very odd that the State Department is being, jobs are not being filled. No one's trying to fill them. Whole agencies are being denuded of people. Bureaucratically, this is kind of crazy if you're Tillerson because, you know, you're like, you're impairing your own ability to function. Some offices should certainly be closed and restructured, and a serious restructure in the State Department, I'm sure, would be a fine idea. But that's not really what's going on here. Like, not filling ambassadorships and things like that is a weird, it just harms your own ability to move and to get things done, and so you have this, as I said, this kind of unilateral disarmament of the leadership of the State Department.
No, it's not just state.
No, but state is. But
every department is underpopulated with right. But that doesn't.
Yeah, that's right. But state is like is actively the leadership of the Department of State on the seventh floor at Foggy Bottom wishes not to have its own people running the State Department. That's the weird part. Like, they don't right. want people in these jobs. It doesn't mean that the jobs don't exist or that there aren't 30 or 40 or 50 people or 100 people working in some bureau. It means that they're just doing it unsupervised and there's no eyeballs on them and they're telling people whatever it is they want to tell them. Like, that's not good management. That's even not good ideological management. If you're worried that the State Department is captured by the deep state swamp awful thing, then you need people on site to be trying to implement policy to which these under people are hostile.
Now, having a no undersecretaries is a big problem.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm just saying. So Tillerson is you know basically impairing the State Department's ability to implement whatever Trump's foreign policy is, and the White House is of course engaged in you know this kind of circular firing squad slaughter that has now ended with, for the moment, with the appointment of General John Kelly as the White House Chief of Staff, has been the Department of Homeland Security Secretary, and you know everyone says he's a fantastic guy. There are these beautiful stories about how he, what he was like as a general during Iraq, how he treated people. This heartbreaking story about him having to tell his wife that their son had been killed in Helmand Province in Afghanistan in 2010, very self-sacrificing, very unpretentious, down-to-earth person, and it's hard, and you know, a very good organizer and a classic military, you know, a man of great self-discipline and believer in discipline, and it's hard to imagine exactly how such a person is going to slot in at the leadership of the Trump White House with Trump at its head and bring order to the chaos that is the direct result of the president's own behavior.
Well, so I feel like there needs to be two distinct boxes where we put the...
Noah just drew two distinct boxes on a post-it next to him.
Where we... I'm illustrating for myself.
Yeah,
okay. Where we put the weak presidency, domestic affairs and foreign affairs. In the domestic sense, this does feel like a radical experiment in a small White House that is not, you know, temperamentally a small White House. It's not filling political positions because it thinks the bureaucracy needs to be trimmed down necessarily. It's just not doing it. And the the Congress sort of disregarding the president's wishes when it comes to major reform legislation is interesting, but it's not going to, you know, change the nature of the country, I don't think. This feels like very unique to this presidency. Similarly with foreign affairs, I feel like this is just an example of what they're doing to this presidency, because this is, as people have noted, a president without a party. So it doesn't necessarily have any ties to the institutional Republican Party, and then institutional Republican Party doesn't have any institutional ties to him. But what does the foreign affairs landscape look like with an acknowledged, understood, weak president who cannot execute his foreign policy objectives with the consent of the country?
Okay, well, we should, Abe, I want you to jump in here, because make it clear that what we're seeing here are developments that suggest that the Trump presidency is institutionally and historically weak, meaning can't get his way with Congress, can't get Congress to do what he wants. He can only get things done by fiat in the executive branch by insisting on them. And we're talking about a president with a Republican House and a Republican Senate, not George H.W. Bush, who came to office with a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate and needed to spend his entire presidency battling them to get things done. If you think about that presidency, it was a one-term presidency, an unsuccessful presidency. A lot of mistakes were made. I wrote a whole book about it called Hell or a Ride. Nonetheless, you know, there was this effort, constant effort, to push certain things that would be of appeal, bipartisan appeal. And what's more, there was an incredibly controversial Supreme Court appointment that got through, for example. It was a different time. It was less partisan. It seemed incredibly partisan at the time, but not like today. But, you know, we got two major pieces of legislation through. We got they are not really Republican pieces of legislation, Americans with Disabilities Act and the extension of the Civil Rights Act of 1991, in part because they were pleasing to Democrats. And he got the Congress to vote favorably for the first Gulf War. So it's not as though a president who ultimately was weak and lost almost everything that would have helped him win a second term, with a Congress of the other party, couldn't get things done historically. Historically, he could. Remember, Clinton had a Republican House and a Republican Senate and got the balanced budget deal through. You know, I mean, again, that was a more conservative piece of legislation, but there it was. So what does that tell you? To me, it says that this is an even weaker, potentially an even weaker presidency than any presidency we have seen in 40 years, because it's his own party he can't get to respond to him. We take it now as a given that the Democrats are, you know, Democrats are going to do nothing, are going to just say no to everything. So this requires a totally unified Republican Party at all points, to get things done. And he's not comfortable with there being a unified Republican Party. He is making no moves, making no efforts, making no gestures toward unifying the party behind him.
Quite the opposite.
Right, okay.
Which exacerbates his weakness, of course, because if he has no rapport with Republicans, he can't get them on board with anything he wants to do. I mean, and we're in a moment where it's sort of like, okay, the secret's out. He's weak. You know, there was a period of time where he was talking, he still talks a big game, but he was talking big game and doing things like dropping the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan, and who knew exactly. But now, you know, we have like Kevin Williamson at National Review wrote this glorious column over the weekend about how, you know, Trump he's sort of a man who is doing his best to pretend to be an alpha.
Well, it wasn't just Kevin's column that presaged this like spate of commentary about how weak Trump is. Peggy Noonan wrote something last week, which is, to my mind, more remarkable, because she was very deferential to his ability to project power in the campaign, the sense of power, she was sensitive to the movement that was attracted to that sense of power. So even that's a little bit more consequential of an acknowledgement to me as opposed to Mr. Williamson, who was never on board the,
right,
the Trump
bandwagon. Right, but I think it's important to note that the whole thing here, again, is Trump believed, for whatever reason, that, you know, he won the presidency and it was the duty of the party to kowtow to him as the winner of the presidency, which is one of the reasons that he tweeted last week that he had dragged so many senators over the finish line by winning, which was simply not true. There is one senator who was reelected in 2016 who was arguably dragged over the finish line. That was Senator Blunt of Missouri. And otherwise, no. Like, every other Republican senator ran ahead of him by several points, meaning that if anything, he might have been a drag on them and not the other way around. But that is the idea of somebody who believes that as the winner of the presidency, it is the role of the party to show fealty to him, whereas in fact, a person with a genuine understanding of how to exercise power and how to lead would have thought of this in an entirely different fashion. He would have put a full court press of charm on Republican senators. He would have met with every single one of them. He would have asked them what their desiderata were. He would have tried to find commonalities with them. He would have played golf with them. He would have done, and the House, because the House is easier. But basically, what he did was he met with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, and he thought if he met with them, that counted for everybody else, and he didn't have to play this game with anybody else. And this then, and we should move on to this point, draws a fascinating parallel with the weakest presidency of modern times, which was Jimmy Carter's. And the parallel between the two of them is very precise, and I'm going to get back to it after I tell you about SimpliSafe, our sponsor, through our friends at Ricochet. A lot of us get excited for summer because it means going on vacation or spending long days at the beach, maybe taking the kids to an amusement park. You know, it gets a burglar excited for summer, knowing that you'll do all these things and leave your house empty. Summer is prime time for burglary. So now is the time to protect your home. For a limited time, you can take a whopping $100 off SimpliSafe's special summer package. This is SimpliSafe's biggest ever summer sale. It is everything you need to protect your home, an arsenal of security sensors to secure each door and window. Your SimpliSafe system comes with a panic button, a blaring extra siren, and a wireless connection to authorities and police dispatch. Your family, your home, and everything in it stays safe around the clock. With SimpliSafe, there are no long-term contracts, no installation costs, no hidden fees, and 24/7 professional monitoring is just $14.99 a month. So this summer, see what SimpliSafe can do for your home. Get $100 off your summer security package at SimpliSafe.com/ricochet. Hurry. That's SimpliSafe.com/ricochet to get your $100 off. Spelled SimpliSafe.com/ricochet for $100 off your purchase. And we thank SimpliSafe for helping to sponsor the Commentary Podcast. Now, Jimmy Carter versus, or analogous to, Donald Trump. Abe, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I mean, what's interesting to me is that we could talk about all the sort of real world consequences of the weakness and how it's manifesting. But there's another commonality, I think, between them, is that, and I think that speaks to both their failings. For Carter, there was the famous malaise speech where he spoke about a sort of, you know, an enervation in American society, and sort of brought the country down. Trump talked about America all through the campaign as if it were a hellhole, you know, as if it was this depressing, awful place. There's something about that. There's this sort of shared pool of misery about where we're at. Now, Trump, of course, his claim was that he was going to change all that through, ironically, strength.
Yeah.
But it speaks to a the same sort of fundamental lack of confidence in the country.
Right. Well, interestingly enough, so the Carter-Malaise speech, which came almost 3 years into his presidency, was a speech in which he essentially sought to fob off the responsibility for his failures on the American people's spiritual descent into the doldrums. What's interesting to me is, institutionally, Carter ran for presidency in 1976 and won the Democratic nomination running as an outsider, as a one-term governor of Georgia, came from nowhere, culturally conservative, politically moderate, evangelical, and the idea was that he would never lie to you. I will never lie to you, and he would come to Washington and clean up the swamp, basically. It was his proposal. And he came to Washington and won this election and proceeded to alienate his party. He was an outsider, so he came in saying he would clean it, but he came in, and by 2 years into his presidency, the entirety of Capitol Hill loathed him. They thought he was a preening, self-righteous, unpleasant, unyielding, ungiving, unfriendly, and statesman-like person who did not assume that any other person in the country had political needs and interests that might diverge from his, and that he needed to take stock of if they were going to make common cause with each other, such that by the time Carter left the presidency, he was fundamentally the first president in history to negotiate a major international treaty that was proved to be so unpopular that it could not even, with his own party, that it could not even be submitted for consideration in the Senate. That was the SALT II Treaty. Now, many things happened to explain that, and, you know, every terrible thing that happened in the Carter presidency, it was all anticipatory until really the three years into his presidency, when there was hyperinflation and employment crisis, and then there was the Three Mile Island melted down, and the Love Canal, there was a giant pollution crisis in the Love Canal, and then these cascading foreign policy disasters: Nicaragua falling, Iran falling, the Soviets installing a brigade in Cuba, and then the Soviets invading Afghanistan, all of which happened in the year 1979, a 12-month of, you know, horror that we still haven't even come remotely close to again. So the issue with Trump is he comes into office. He also has a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate, you know, of his own party, excuse me. And he's alienating them. He's alienating them in exactly the same way. He's treating them high-handedly. He's attacking some of them if he doesn't like them. You know, he's not courting the ones who are giving him trouble, like Jeff Flake or you know, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, or, you know, various members. He's not courting them. He, again, wants them to bend the knee, like Daenerys Targaryen wanted with Jon Snow on last night's Game of Thrones. But I said I was not going to talk about Game of Thrones. But she demanded that Jon Snow bend the knee, and he's like, I'm not bending the knee to you. We have mutual interests. Let's try to make a deal together. But that's not his approach. His approach is it's my way or the highway, and I'm the guy, and you stink. Now that, and this I think was Kevin Williamson's point, that is not the way a real alpha behaves. A real alpha is confident, comfortable, and serene in his leadership such that he can surrender a little bit of his power to get more of it.
I mean, and the funny thing is, in Kevin Williamson's piece, he was sort of talking about the theatrics of being an alpha, and how, you know, there's a certain type of man, Trump being one, sort of pretends to act like an alpha when he's really not. But the funny thing is that there is, within the sort of, if you are a true alpha man, or if you are a real leader, there is an element of theatrics that you do have to bring to bear that Trump does not have at all, and that is acting level-headed when things are blowing up around you. That is being calm and humorous in the face of tragedy. Trump cannot do any of that. When anything goes mildly wrong, he takes to Twitter and whines and complains.
So I wonder whether, on the domestic side of things, I suppose that the libertarian impulse in me, and maybe others listening to this podcast, just say, okay, that's fine. We have a handcuffed presidency. They're not going to do much. Even if they don't roll back some of the things that they wish was going to be rolled back from the Obama years, at least they're not going to, you know, do harm. But on the foreign policy front, I wonder whether or not the weak presidency matters so much if we have a non-Carter-like figure in the White House. I find it very difficult to draw a parallel between Jimmy Carter's foreign policy and Trump's, whereas Barack Obama's seems like a much more cogent parallel, because you had somebody who was very much interested in redefining American objectives in Barack Obama, and you had someone who was very much interested in redefining American objectives in Jimmy Carter, although they did it in a different way. And Barack Obama's presidency was a lot less deferential to human rights than the Carter presidency was. They all had different ideas about who America's true alliances were or should be, and actively worked to reshape the map to that effect. Trump has conducted a much more traditional foreign policy, even though it has been kind of weaker. It was sort of Barack Obama's ability to shift the map in his head to something that was much more beneficial, that allowed Putin the freedom that he felt to invade and annex territory in Europe, to intervene in Syria, to allow the North African coast to set itself on fire, for American alliances in traditionally despotic regimes to fear for their safety and their security of their regime, and whether or not they had a friend in the White House. And that's sort of more Carter-like. That's more, well, Cuba's going to invade Angola.
Okay, first of all, it's only 6 months. We're only 6-7 months into the administration, so we don't know how the world is going to – the world is still sizing Trump up. I think it's fair to say that if it is the general sense that he is a weak president domestically, that it will not escape the attention of the rest of the world, which will assume that that weakness is also is a matter of his character and not simply an element of his domestic policy.
But there is a difference that I think Noah's getting at, which is that Obama wanted to institute policies that were weak. And he succeeded in doing that.
Well, so did Carter. I mean, remember,
right.
Carter.
No, but I'm thinking
but
Trump.
Carter was the. Right. Carter was.
He's
the,
too ineffectual to institute some sort
right.
of a harmful
yeah.
policy.
But I mean, Carter. Carter was the post-Vietnam president, and he basically the complaint against him with the Soviet Union was that he negotiated a SALT II deal that enshrined American. That was going to permit the Soviet Union to have more warheads, more nuclear warheads than the United States, that he was so eager to make a deal that would constrain the United States' ability to win the Cold War, let's say, that he was even willing to sort of give the Soviet Union dominance in one area. So in that sense, there was something to the notion that the Carter and Obama presidencies were analogous. But Carter's again, this goes to the question of Carter was interested in foreign policy. I don't think Obama in the end was really that interested in foreign policy. I mean, he wanted to make deals, but, you know, he was, you know, his Trump is not interested in foreign policy.
Right, that's what I'm saying. And his weakness is not necessarily ideological. It's something much closer to it's characterological. He can't get to the point to institute these policies, weak, strong, good, right. bad, or otherwise.
Well, look, I will say that I think there's a parallel in Trump's case between the speech that he gave in New York the other day and his foreign policy, which is that he gave this speech in which he sort of jokingly, but nothing is ever really jokingly, said he thought cops should, you know, be tough on people they arrested. They should let their heads bang into the cars instead of helping them push their heads down, and they should throw them in the paddy wagon and let them bang around in the back and all of that. And that all sounds, again, like fakey alpha. It's like, you know, yeah, be tough on those criminals. They suck and they stink and all of that, right? And so that also goes to the, we should just bomb the hell out of ISIS and we should bomb them and take their oil and we should, it's all a kind of affect, a toughness affect. But it's not real toughness. I mean, like, real toughness is, you sit at a negotiating table with somebody who is trying to get one over on you, supposedly this great deal maker, and you say no, and you just keep saying no, and you say, I'm stronger than you, I don't need this. And foreign policy toughness is a matter of constant observation of where American interests lie and how not to be seduced by the idea that you should surrender the American interest because you're interlocutor, the person you're negotiating with, has difficulties of his own and troubles of his own, and you really need to help him get to agreement.
That's where the Trump administration could get into some real trouble here, because they do fancy themselves deal makers. And in order to make a deal, you offer concessions. And the Trump administration is really quick to offer concessions on a lot of areas where even they say they're not interested in being conciliatory. They do. They know what their parties, their interlocutors' interests are, and they try to see to that. And I don't think they have a firm grasp of what American national interests are, what a grand strategy is for this country. And so but they do understand what their adversaries' interests are, and they'll possibly get themselves into a little bit of trouble further on by providing more concessions than they probably should, and thus exemplifying weakness where another adversary could feel free to take advantage of that.
Well, I would say also that we have the case, in the case of Trump, again analogous to Carter, perhaps, that with the exception of Israel, Trump is perfectly willing to look at America's allies and friends around the world, or even people with whom we have a common interest, and be nasty to them for no particular obvious reason, which was a Carter byproduct, was a clear Carter thing, and the famous reason that gave the famous set of sort of pompous arch assertions of virtue that led to Jean Kirkpatrick writing her famous commentary article, Dictatorships and Double Standards, according to which she said, look, there are different dictatorships come in different shapes and sizes, and there are dictatorships, authoritarian dictatorships are not as bad as totalitarian ones, and sometimes you have to choose between one or the other, and you should choose the one that's friendlier to you and is less bad than the other, because that's how the real world works, right? So, Trump, I think, seems to feel totally comfortable, as Obama did and as Carter did, in like being nasty to Germany and nasty to allies and slighting, and then had this bizarre continuing effort, despite some of these policy things, of trying to be nice to Russia, which is still the great puzzling aspect of this. Like, you can be, you can't be, you can think well of Putin or think badly of Putin, but the constant unwillingness to sort of acknowledge that, Putin's a bad actor publicly, even though is weird. And so that's one of the things that caused Congress to vote to strip his power of freedom of movement in relation to Russia.
Now, I also want to get into the question which you had raised before we started, which is, okay, so the secret of his weakness is sort of out among us and others. When, if ever, does his base find out?
Well, I think he knows how to play it so that his base won't know unless they're paying very close attention. However, having said that, when things went bad for Jimmy Carter, they went bad for Jimmy Carter all at once, both in terms of public opinion and in terms of how the world was responding to him. A Trump who is viewed as not strong by his base, and not just by his base, but by Republican voters in general, who is not viewed as a strong leader, is a dead duck. I don't mean he's dead because he'll be impeached. I mean he's a dead duck for a second term. He's a dead duck in terms of any... That was it. That's what he was selling. What he was selling was he was strong, Hillary was weak. Hillary was weak, and she was fainting, and she was weak, and she was a crook, and she was a weak crook. And if he starts seeming weak, at some point, his people will start having contempt for him, unless, and this is the real trick, unless the culture war in this country is so strong and so potent and so powerful that the fact that he is not a Democrat and the fact that he is not for all kinds of, including, pitching that he's for banning transgender people in the military, that is a giant signal to his base that he is not playing by the PC rules of the big cities. And maybe that's all he'll need. So even though they think he's weak, he's at least not them. He's us and he's not them. Or he's one of them who is willing to side with us, which is probably more the truth. I don't know. Noah, what do you think?
No, I think that's perfectly fine. I also think it doesn't matter. I think it's utterly irrelevant because we're talking about a guy with a job approval rating under 40%. I don't think we're talking about the 2016 election where you have a lot of people who are disapproving of him and then also saying, well, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and vote for him. We're not talking about an election. We're not talking about anything that matters beyond the fact that this is a presidency who has command of a very small minority, if not a plurality of the Republican Party, but a minority of the electorate. And there's going to be a referendum on his presidency in 2 years on which he's not on the ballot. The base, the obsession that we in the political commentary community have with his base voters vexes me beyond belief. I just don't think it's necessary or relevant to the topic, but it dominates the conversation.
But forget the base. So let's just go with the 46% of Americans in the last election who voted for him, right? So forget the base, because the base is probably, you know, 66% of that, right? Something like that. Like it's two-thirds of that?
66% of 46%?
Yeah. Right, so it's two-thirds of the 46%, or, you know, half of the 46%. Half to two-thirds.
Yeah, about 36% of the country.
Okay. The question is, they, I think, even more than the base, were voting for him because he was a strong leader. I mean, they weren't voting for him because they approved of him as a human being, or they weren't voting for him because they liked his policies and stuff like that. I think they looked at him and Hillary and said he was stronger than she, and they were gonna stronger, like it was worth taking a bet on him, because at least he wasn't her.
I think that we've somehow forgotten that it's very difficult for a party to retain three consecutive terms in the White House. It's only happened once since World War II. It's not something that happens very often. There's a whole lot of headwinds facing
Hillary Clinton. I know, but she still won the popular vote. I mean, that remains the great ambiguity of this election. I mean, he won the Electoral College, and that's how we count the presidency.
But it's still...
She got 3 million more voters than he did.
The likelihood is that these people who we call the Trump base will find some sort of rationalization for their support for him. It could be cultural, it could be what have you. They'll discover it in themselves. I just don't think it matters, especially if this is a weak presidency, right. And that's what's going to shape the American political
landscape.
Well,
that speaks again. Like now we're going totally far afield. But so, Abe, let me just ask you this. So Trump becomes the issue in 2020 the way Hillary was the issue in 2016. Ultimately, the idea was who was more of an issue. Was Trump more of an issue or Hillary more of an issue, right? Like, were you more negatively disposed toward Hillary or more negatively disposed toward Trump? And marginally, so nationwide, people were marginally more. But, you know, where it mattered, where you could get the electoral votes, people thought that Hillary was marginally less safe or worse or whatever. So in 2020, Trump's the issue. And the question is going to be better or worse than him. Still strikes me that we have in the Democratic Party an interesting challenge then, because the issue isn't going to be satisfying the Democratic base. It's going to be something else, maybe, if that's the question. The question is, how do you get somebody to make sure that the election is a referendum on Trump and not on them?
Yeah, I mean...
Always, if it's Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, I think it's not that hard for Trump to make the election at least as much a referendum on them as it is on him.
That's right. I mean, we may be at the point by then where there's this sense we've had it with these, you know, sort of mold breaking, fire breathing candidates. You know, who knows where the Bernie mystique or similar phenomena will be by then. I mean, the true referendum could be we don't want craziness anymore. You know, it's a referendum on unpredictable, out of the box chaos.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that would I'm thinking as I'm thinking aloud here that you want somebody either who is a bit of a Rorschach test, you know, or can be all things to all people, kind of a, you know, slightly faceless person of some accomplishments that you can stick whatever you want to on them, or a huge celebrity. That's the Oprah model. Right. Well, the Oprah model is a little bit, you could say in policy terms, the other. Or, you know, Biden, because, you know, if he's 77 years old, but he's only going to do one term. But, you know, in the end, if you're picking, is Biden really somebody that you're hostile to, that you look at and you say he's a crook or he's disgusting or he makes you sick or something like that? I don't know. I mean, I think he's a fool and a silly person. Right. and would be an embarrassment to the presidency in a different way. But I don't know. I mean, if Trump's too hot, yeah, being a little cooler is probably what you need, and someone who's also sort of likable in a different way.
I wonder if by then, or even by now, Biden retains the working class appeal that.
But we're talking about 3 years from now. Think about how much is going to be different if this presidency continues apace, and there are no accomplishments. And it becomes Jimmy Carter in the foreign field, and things look really bad abroad, then you have what was clearly and obviously an attempt to change the conversation last week when the president announced via Twitter a ban on transgenders in the military, and then proceeded a few minutes later to say, okay, now let's get back to talking about Jeff Sessions. Think of all the cultural controversies that are going to be dredged up. From nowhere. By the way, this was Barack Obama's specialty. Barack Obama did this very cleverly by being able to inject random social controversies into the ether and dominate the conversation.
Trump is even better at it in some ways.
He's much better at it. So, and he does so from a conservative perspective, left doesn't really understand.
So it's impossible to game that out because you just don't know.
Right.
You just don't know where the cross currents are.
But if there's going to be a referendum, it'll be as much on the presidency as it will be on all these other various social controversies that he will conjure up for the election, which Barack Obama did in 2012.
Look, in 2012, the genius of the Obama campaign in 2012 was in making Romney the subject of the race. If you think about it, it's crazy. Why, was Romney too mean to be president, ultimately? And it was a genius play, and they spent $100 million trashing him in Ohio, and, that kind of thing. So that's not the ordinary thing. Like, ordinarily, it's reelect me, things are better. Clinton in 96, things are better. Reagan in 84, things are better. That's Eisenhower in 56, things are better. Obama didn't have that much to say were better, and his main accomplishment was unpopular. Obamacare was unpopular. So he did manage to turn tail and make the election about his opponent. And that will be the challenge for Trump under these circumstances. It's very hard for me to see that that effort can get beyond that unpopularity that you talk about, Noah. But we don't know about the 2018 elections, which will be a referendum on him, and yet they still have to have candidates on the ballot that people can vote for. Democrats need candidates on the ballot who are acceptable enough so that you can cast a protest vote for them. They can't be Democratic versions of the guys who made it impossible for Republicans to win the Senate in 2010 and 2012.
They've done fine recruiting for the specials.
Right. But I'm saying you can't be the Democratic version of Richard Murdoch in Indiana or Todd Akin in Kansas or Sharon Angle in Nevada. It has to be somebody that you can vote for.
Oh, right before we went on the air, so to speak, you had the DCCC campaign operative saying that they will invest in and fund pro-life Democratic candidates. And that created a huge firestorm on the left because this is an absolute offense to the decency of every pro-choice woman in America.
That is so big.
But it's a big deal.
That is big. And you know what else is big? This podcast. It's too long. It's too big. It's the size of
Abe Greenwald's
the Khaleesi's
Twitter
dragon. I was saying the Khaleesi's dragons, but I promised
Abe Greenwald's fan base.
And Greenwald's Abe Greenwald's fan base may mean that he will have the capacity to storm King's Landing and take the Iron Throne from Cersei Lannister. But I told you I wasn't going to talk about Game of Thrones. So when we talk next time, there will be no mention of Game of Thrones. I could go into Twin Peaks. I don't know. I'm watching Ozark, by the way. Which is not bad on Netflix if you want to give it a shot. Not bad. It's not fantastic, but it's not bad.
You haven't watched Snowfall at all, have you?
No, is it good?
I'm liking it.
Snowfall. That's the history of crack, right?
It's a history.
A
of
history
crack.
Of crack.
It's a very very fanciful one.
Yeah. No, you have anything to anything you're watching?
No. You had mentioned about a year ago were rewatching Rome.
And I decided
I'm forcing my wife to get into it because Game of Thrones, but actually happened.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. It gets a little crazy in the second season. But one parallel between Game of Thrones and Rome is that the woman, Indira Varma, who plays the wife in Rome, is one of the sand snakes on Game of Thrones, last night seen in a jail cell in King's Landing. But I said I wasn't going to talk about Game of Thrones.
The gentleman who played Brutus is a Lannister.
Indeed he is. Indeed he is. There are a bunch of people. That's right. Anyway, so... you know, because this is life in our time. Like, basically, you're just going from TV show to TV show. Because what else is there to do? Otherwise, you have to pay even more attention to politics, which is very depressing. So, for Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I am John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.